Thank you again for having me speak here, again on the theme of choose life in medical ethics. And again, I would remind you of the theme verse, Deuteronomy 30:19. I call to heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both thou and thy seed may live. We went over the first example last time of the treacheries of moral relativism with Eve in the Garden of Eden, who bought into Satan's lies, Genesis 3, 4, and 5. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So it's clear now that what Satan promised was the lie that if we left God, if we became our own gods, we could determine for ourselves what's right and wrong. So how's that working for us in our society in general? Have we as a people had enough divorce, abortion, warfare, spiritual poverty? How's that for running our own, in our own ways, in our own sight? We talked about in Isaac Watts' Logic or the Right Use of Reasons, how to identify those things that get in our way of godly thinking. For example, the temptation to draw quick conclusions. Meritocracy. This such and such person has a degree, so what he says must be true. Not recognizing our own blind spots. Identifying the willful ignorance in our lives. If we can't stand the answer, don't ask any questions. That kind of thinking. Not recognizing bias in what we feed ourselves and our families through the media, through books that we read, things that we listen to, and that sort of thing. Those things hinder our way of godly thinking. And then confusion. Not relying on the plain and simple truths of the scriptures. In short, truth and logic are not necessarily the same thing. I remember how I spoke about, in a humorous way, the logic in the statement, I am tall, the tree is tall, so I must be a tree. But more ominously, I can take a life, God can take a life, so I must be God. These are kinds of things that that show that logic and truth are not the same thing. In rejecting these principles of godly thinking, humanism, where logic is valued over godly truth, that is the result. In it, man is viewed as basically good, and without God can solve the world's problems. The fittest elites, of course, would determine what's the best for the rest. Their science is Darwinism, their government is socialism and communism, their religion is atheism, all in which the fit have dominion over the unfit. So with this foundation, once we determine whose lead to follow and identify the pitfalls, we can try to tackle some of these medical ethical problems. But we have to first answer, is man inherently good or is he fallen? Is man in control or is God in control? Do we seek after truth or logic? In looking at anthropomorphism, we saw how the Apostle Paul stated in 2 Titus 4, 3 and 4, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. And they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. So there's this drive in man through the ages to recreate himself into the image of his desires, melding man and animal. This is how this, and so we saw how this was creating confusion in our children's minds, in essence, free advertising for Darwinism. If Peter Cottontail was an animal and I act and think in the same way, I must also be an animal. Or how when barriers differentiating man and animal are torn down, the plight of animals are not lifted to the level of the man, but we are dragged down to the level of animals. And how this concept, this anthropomorphism, is like mind candy. It's junk food for the soul. One sister I spoke with last time after the talk talked to me about how those old solid Bible stories didn't have the attraction they once had once the children started reading the glossy fairy tale or fantasy stories. So let's feed our children and ourselves only nutritional soul food. Now, with that in mind, let's move on to genetic engineering, which would be the next logical step. Anthropomorphism is the fantasy of melding animal and man. Genetic engineering is actually the conceptualization and the attempt to make that to bring that to fruition. When I was to illustrate this little anecdote, when I was preparing for this talk, one of my sons, who will remain anonymous, but I think you could probably figure out who it is, those of you who go to school with him, asked me about why a black light makes white things glow. So we looked it up. And if you're curious, and if you must know, it's the phosphorus in the detergent that absorbs the energy, then releases it in the form of light when it's struck by the certain wavelengths of the black light. But when we looked it up, we came across the picture of a mouse that glowed in the dark in one of these science magazines or science articles. When I explained to him that the mouse was genetically engineered to have the genes of a jellyfish, and if you didn't know that jellyfish, many jellyfish glow in the dark, but he had the genes, this mouse had the genes of a jellyfish spliced into its DNA, his eyes began to glow. And he just started getting this big smile across his face. And his ears might start to be glowing red right now, because I might be embarrassing him a little bit. But when I told him that technology was a decade old, he was kind of awestruck, because it actually has been around for quite a while. and it's also allowed human growth genes to be spliced into to mice, and I told him different things that have been done. And it caused them to be twice as big as they usually are. And so I could tell the gears were turning and a little smoke was coming out of his ears. And he said, well, why don't we splice elephant genes into the mouse and get it really big? So I had to kind of tell him that this genetic engineering is kind of a morally volatile area, and that it made everything that we can do, we don't necessarily have to do. It may not be pleasing to the Lord, recalling that God found it good that creatures procreated after their own kind. Now, that last part that I told him kind of extinguished any trace of a smile that he may have had. But it's not so hard to see from that point, yes, you probably could transpose an elephant gene into a mouse, but you could also transpose an elephant gene into a person. So we start getting into this slippery slope and this demonstration of how it captures people's imaginations. From there, there's the practical application of genetic engineering is gene therapy, where you use genetically engineered viruses to correct some inborn genetic defects and even to fight cancer. It's done by modifying the viruses, and what viruses normally do is they attack the cells, they go into the nucleus, and they change the DNA. So if you can modify these viruses to insert the gene for whatever protein is deficient, be it hemophilia or maple syrup urine disease, different things like that, you can cure these diseases. and so that's how gene therapy works. And many of you farmers already know, too, that there are many things, good things that can come of genetic engineering. Things that are already in use, genetically modified corn, soybean, other crops, that cause them to increase the crop yields, their hardiness, their nutritional value. And I'm sure some of you farmers could probably tell me a thing or two about genetically modified crops. And then there's transgenic animals, kind of like what we talked about right from the beginning of this genetic engineering, the anecdote that I just talked to you about. In industry, there's transgenic goats that can have that have spider silk inserted into their the genes that produce milk. And so when you milk these goats, you get the spider silk out of them in the small form, and it's combined, and it can be concentrated into making some very strong fibers. So there's an industrial component to this. And in medicine, there's quite a few applications of this, in which the genes that some people lack for, say, insulin or clotting factors for hemophiliacs are inserted into these animals' genes. And again, you can milk them, or they're just produced in different bodily fluids in their blood and so forth, and they can be taken. It can be taken out and used in people, and even bacteria. Bacteria was one of the first things because they were genetically very simple. Bacteria could be used to produce things like insulin. And if the truth be told, before I became an astronautical engineer, before I was a pilot, before I was a doctor, I had a desire to become a genetic engineer. Because what boy hasn't thought of flying like a bird or swimming like a fish? In theory, it wouldn't be too hard. Just splice in some wing genes from a bird or the gill genes of a fish. And in practicality, though, it's tremendously more complex. However, it's technologically not unimaginable. And as I described in the case of anthropomorphism, there's this incredible drive for man to recreate himself independent of God. And now, believe it or not, these things are actually being conceptualized. But before we go from there, we should back up a little bit and look at the history of genetic engineering and its roots. Taken to its humanist extremes, without God again, it has a very dark side. The father of this, or the root of this genetic engineering, is called eugenics, which has been around for a long time. Eu means good, genetics means genes, good genes. In the 1700s, going back as far as the 1700s, even before that, but in the 1700s, Frederick the Great of Germany created a regimen of giants. They were called the Potsdam Grenadier Guard. Friedrich Nietzsche, a humanist of the first degree, in fact, he was probably considered one of the founders of humanism, promoted the idea of the Übermensch, the super-Aryan race, and he eventually died of insanity. In this country, we had Margaret Sanger, whose slogan, and she was the originator of Planned Parenthood, her slogan was, more of the fit, less of the unfit. And you can see, again, the Darwinian ties there, fit and unfit. And, of course, there's Adolf Hitler, who attempted to perfect the human race by culling what he thought were the inferior races to the tune of tens of millions of people. Now, what about today? Currently, work is being done to introduce numerous genes into pig organs so that they can be used for human transplantation. Pig genes are somewhat similar to human genes, as are all different species we have, our similarities and differences. Pigs have less differences. So the idea here is to introduce human genes into the pig organs so that they won't be rejected if they're transplanted. Currently, we already use pig and beef valves in people, or pig valves in people. But other organs are conceptualized into using them for transplantation because of the chronic shortage of organs. The more human genes, the less chance of rejection. But the question remains, how many genes does it take before an animal takes on some kind of form of humanity? In 2003, researchers successfully combined human and rabbit embryos and then destroyed the being. Did it have a soul? This was kind of monumental in that the number of chromosomes are different, but they were able to meld the two for at least a short period of time. So it kind of begs the question, where are we going with this? And what would have happened if they didn't destroy it? In the near future, genetic diseases that affect many people will be likely deleted through gene therapy. So if it's okay to delete or repair defective genes, would it be okay to program into designer babies a high degree of strength or intelligence? How short is short before it's considered a defective gene, or is it more aesthetic? And how tall is tall? How tall do we want people to be? If it'll give them an edge up in society, you can bet that it'll probably happen. You've heard of heirloom varieties of tomatoes and chickens. What will become of the heirloom variety of people that are kind of left behind if everyone goes for designer babies? So, does this kind of make your head swim? Is there confusion? Who's in control of this? These are all things that, remember, we have to keep asking when we have to decide how are we going to handle these situations. What happens to peace and order when we try to put ourselves in control? Is there really any control when we put ourselves in control? And so when I was putting this section of the talk together, I was thinking of Psalms 119, 133. Order my steps in thy word, and let not any iniquity have dominion over me. So these are kind of my thoughts after much thought and prayer. How do I look at this kind of thing? You determine if there's any ring of truth to it. In all these technologies that we're discussing here, there's usually a good twin and an evil twin. If you kind of look at it in very basic terms, there's good technology that nobody has qualms about. There's bad technology that set up red flags all over the place. And there's some other, whatever's left is kind of in between. We need to separate what's good and evil and seek the Lord's wisdom for the rest. In the case of genetic therapy, gene therapy, in which the person's actual DNA is changed, I believe that to do so before conception is too morally dangerous. The slippery slope is just too deep. It's too steep. It's evil twin. That is the evil twin. We simply don't have the wisdom to know where to stop in trying to create a superhuman. It's kind of like programming into a computer designer baby according to your specifications, and out pops an embryo ready for transplantation. Gene therapy after conception, I would see as the good twin, where there's a clear boundary of time and balance and time for prayer to determine if a change or a cure is really needed. And if it is done, it's very limited. As far as transgenic animals and that kind of thing, I have to admit I don't have a really clear solution. What I've come up with, though, is that it's pleasing to God to keep animals or beings, the likes, in their own categories. Changing one gene does not change the essence of that animal. However, changing and splicing together two different beings, a chimera where you have a rabbit and a human, that changes the basic concept of that being, and that's clearly, I think, would be out of bounds. But this is where the church needs to come together and learn how to address these topics, because these issues are coming up. In fact, they've already come up, especially with genetically modified foods, and soon will be genetically modified animals. And they'll happen, and we won't know what happened until we look behind us. So I'm going to go ahead and move on to stem cells. And then I'll probably take some questions afterwards. Stem cells. What are stem cells? Stem cells are cells that are immature. In simple terms, they haven't decided what they want to do when they grow up. They may develop into brain, bone, kidney, skin, or any other tissue. And there's basically two forms of stem cells, adult and embryonic. The adult stem cells come from people who are already born. Everyone has them. They're kind of like the 30-year-old that still lives in his father's basement, doesn't have a job, just kind of bumming around doing nothing. With a little prodding, they can grow up into a budding career as any number of specialized tissue types. Embryonic stem cells are taken from human embryos after conception, and the process destroys them, snuffing out their young lives by researchers. So what's all the fuss about stem cells? The great hope of stem cells is that they have the potential to regenerate injured and worn out tissues and organs. A paralyzed person with a spinal cord injury could have a cord patched. That's in very simplified terms, but that's the hope. A patient with a worn out heart could have it regenerated. A dialyzed man could have a new kidney. Those who support abortion have great hopes that embryonic stem cells would be the key. California voters recently dedicated $3 billion to embryonic-only stem cell research. Yes, this is the same California that has a $20 billion deficit. So why is it so important for them? The idea was that if they could find a treatment using the stem cells from destroyed embryos, and if that was the only treatment around, pro-life people would be forced to decide between the potentially life-saving treatment or death, or living with the disease. If they accepted the treatments, the pro-life people that is, they couldn't criticize this form of abortion, or really any abortion, since they benefited from it. That was the thought. If the patient was a minor, and this was the only treatment, a court order could be obtained to force that patient to have the treatment. It's kind of like if you hear people who are rejecting leukemia treatments, and by court order they have to receive it. So this would circumvent the family's conscience. Despite the extra billions of dollars, the only problem for them is that the only success has been with adult stem cells. Only adult stem cell therapy has moved beyond the research phase to this treatment stage. And that's because the embryonic stem cells, I would call this the evil twin, is too immature to know when to turn itself off. They do replace the damaged tissue, but they can't stop. In essence, they turn into a kind of a cancer, and there have been many catastrophic results from using and attempting embryonic stem cells. Adult stem cells, I'll call that the good twin, is superior since it comes from that specific person and is cultured and multiplied and then returned back to that specific person. So the take-home point here is that God is faithful and that he will supply our answers. Luke 11:9 comes to mind. And I say unto you, ask and it shall be given you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you. So this issue kind of hits home to me. I personally have had a certain degree of kidney failure, so this isn't really an abstract issue. And I know and care for dialysis patients, and I know it's not a picnic. It's kind of like looking in the window of my future and what's in store for me 10, 20 years down the line, and when that's not easy. But I do know that God is in control. And if we're faithful in seeking morally sound solutions, he will provide them. The ends, which is curing the disease, is only justified by godly means. Still, we have to accept his control, realizing that he may have other plans for us, either here on earth or in his mansion in the sky. Eventually, technology will leapfrog some of these morally tainted technologies. 10 years ago, I pretty much gave the same talk, and my major concern back then was the utilization of aborted babies being used for transplants. Back then, that was the major push in research. Imagine, if you will, a diabetic who could just have some aborted baby pancreatic tissue injected in their forearm and then be kind of cured. No more shots, no more complications such as heart attacks, blindness, kidney failure. Of course, if your child had diabetes, and you chose not to have them treated with fetal tissue, you'd be subject to child endangerment charges. At least that was the thinking back then. But I felt then, as I do now, with this push with embryonic stem cells, that such research is a conscious effort to get Christians to compromise, to accept this and other forms of moral relativism. And if you recall the last talk that we had, amongst self-declared Christians, born-again Christians, only a minority, 46 or 47%, believed in absolute moral truth. So it's things like this that eat away at our foundations and lead us to question things like absolute truth. Today, such research into using the fetal tissue is moot because of the discovery of the stem cell technologies. It's much more efficient and much more closer to what we want for this kind of thing. Eventually, organs will be grown in a lab from the individual's own stem cells, and transgenic animals won't be needed, as the necessary proteins will be more efficiently produced in the lab by chemical reactions rather than through this animal farming. God is faithful in providing us for both spiritually and our physical needs. We simply need to be faithful, and we need to accept His will and timing for us. At this point, I'll take a couple questions here, if you have any, before I proceed. Yes.
Well, I would ruminate with you about the logic versus truth idea. It seems to me that if perhaps you're reaching for the Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 terminology, that trust in the Lord and lean not unto thy own understanding, that might be similar to what you're reaching for, because human logic
okay, where is the role of faith?
I grant that we humans need to have faith because we can't figure everything out.
And you're correct in pointing out that all logic is based on assumptions, but how do we know the assumptions are correct? Sure. Logic and truth should be the same. They should be the same. But however, when we rely on solely logic without seeking for truth, that's where we fall into the trap, and that's where humanism is wrong, because it relies on logic without seeking for truth. Maybe you agree with that. Yes.
Okay, what you're saying is logic, by its nature, have an assumption to start.
Sure.
Okay.
The sky is blue. What's
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so you're saying faith gives us a starting place.
It gives us the foundation, yes.
Okay. But then don't we require logic to be able to understand?
I would say if the results of logic is contrary to truth, what we understand as being truth and what we know is truth, then you have to look at your assumptions and you have to look at your reasoning, because anything can be proven logically.
Okay,
based on tweaking your...
But let's say we start with a basic foundation like thou shalt not kill. That's in the Bible, that's foundation.
Right.
Okay, so we use logic to apply that to our lives. If God told us not to kill, that means we don't kill. That means we don't do a number of other things.
Right.
So we do have to have logic, but we use it to seek out the truth that God...
Right. If you look at some of the scientists like Louis Pasteur and some of, basically, just about all the scientists, even Galileo. Galileo is a good, great humanistic icon of logic over truth. If you actually look at him, he was actually a very faithful person. But the difference between modern science and classical science is that they sought to make logic and truth in a perfect union. If their results of their logic were contrary to truth, then they'd scratch their head a little bit, and they'd go back and look at their assumptions, basically. And that's where logic is at its weakest, is the assumptions. And they looked to make those two congruent. Today, scientists are, if anything, they're out to disprove truth and faith. And so they will alter their assumptions to make those proofs, those quote-unquote proofs. That's the difference. Yes?
I think I sort of hear what you're saying, that we have to be faithful to the axioms or assumptions that Scripture gives us. And I think that Nietzsche actually was, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but was actually commissioned by the church initially to prove, using only logic, that all the assumptions of the Christian worldview were true. And that by pushing away those assumptions and working only with logic is what led him to his philosophical conclusions. And there, I think there's some axiom or some assumptions even within the Christian faith that have trouble working with logic. For example, Christ's divinity and humanness. And so I think that, like you said, logic does have sort of limited value sometimes. As we're faithful to scriptural assumptions or scriptural axioms. But I think maybe the biggest key, I guess, is just being faithful to or choosing the right assumptions and choosing the right axioms.
Mm-hmm. Again, leaning not on our own understanding and. Yeah, I wasn't aware of the church commissioning him for that reasoning, but that might be worthwhile looking into, seeing where he stumbled. But, yes, David. Especially the social scientists. That's the more that the logic relies on assumptions that are user-defined, then the higher, the more room for making trouble and making these so-called facts subjective there is. So. Okay, I'm just going to move on here to the next issue, and if you recall the last time that I spoke, I talked to you about feeling kind of like Jonah, not wanting to really address this topic and kind of run away from it. This is the part that I was referring to. It's the one about birth control, and on an individual basis, I don't have any problems discussing this with people coming to see me. However, and it's been very difficult to stand here before you and talk about such a very personal thing, and I will try and keep it in very general terms so you don't have to worry about your younger children. This is a tremendously emotionally charged topic, and it's not my intention to dictate or browbeat anyone into agreement. And furthermore, when I refer to birth control, I'm more concerned about its effect on our spiritual lives, and I'm not referring to those that need to limit children for whatever significant health reasons that they may have. My only desire here is to provide you with information and insight that may help you develop your own convictions. And some of the reasons that I'm giving to you are not meant to convince you logically that this is the best thing. It's still something that should be born out of conviction. Any of the statistics and things that I talk to you about here, I would view more as proof and things that reinforce those convictions if you have them. But if you will, just bear with me and determine yourself whether or not there's any element of truth in this. So let me start out with this topic with kind of a summary. We believe debt is a curse and children are a blessing, yet we apply for the curse and reject the blessing. And that kind of sums up the start of it anyway. just a few background facts. The Comstock Law of 1873 made it illegal to advertise or distribute any contraceptive information or devices. And there was unified opposition to birth control among all Christian denominations almost to the mid-20th century. It was obvious then that the widespread availability would lead to promiscuity and would detract from the meaning and the value of marriage. Today, I don't know why, this is an unclear and abstract concept. Somehow we've lost that concept. The pill, to much fanfare in the media, just celebrated its 50th birthday this year. there's no such thing as the car or the shoe, but everyone knows what the pill is. And it's not penicillin. and that one saved millions of lives. But the hormone that I'm talking about has prevented or taken millions of lives, and I'll explain later. The pill was not firmly established as legal to prescribe, even amongst married people, until the 1965 Griswold court decision. And it wasn't until 1972 that it was determined to be legally prescribed amongst unmarried people, unmarried women. It's not a coincidence that abortion was made legal, or should I say the illegality of abortion was made illegal, by the year 1973. Though I'll get into this later, but briefly, the end goal was to limit children. Birth control is one means to that end. But when it fails, as it does on occasion, abortion was the other necessary means to bridge the gap to achieve the same ends. So in other words, the ends were the same, having no children. It was only by the means that were different. We're talking about birth control versus abortion. And oftentimes, they work together. To most people in the world, the rejection of the birth control was most closely associated with the Catholic Church. And the Pope at that time wrote a letter to all his congregations. It's called Humana Vitae, which is Latin for issues of life, to all the churches in his denomination. And he made four predictions. That birth control would lead to marital infidelity. It would lead to a moral coarsening of society. It would lead men to cease respecting women and would cause them to treat them as instruments of selfish enjoyment rather than cherished partners. And finally, the widespread acceptance of birth control would lead to massive imposition of contraception by unscrupulous governments. And this last point has special relevance to our family. Two of our children that are with us are as a direct result of this humanistic social engineering. In China, the state forces abortion on some women and other forms of birth control on millions of women, and many of them have to have their children in hiding, only forced to abandon the children later. The West, we in the West don't say anything as long as we have access to unfettered access to abortion. And a lot of that is because of the belief that the masses of yellow and brown people need to be in check. So this really isn't a trivial issue. It's a matter of life and death. The victims are real, and some of them are sitting here amongst you. And even in our Christian community, one evangelist said that you got to do what you got to do when you have so many people. And that just kind of floored me, because where is the light? Where, how are we Christian light if we go along with this kind of thing? But those predictions all came true, needless to say. Although I believe many in our own circles had some of those concerns. And again, I'll remind you my disclaimer. Yes, last time I talked, I was raised Catholic. And aside from the numerous false doctrinal issues, one of the main reasons I left the church was that there was no conversion among the vast majority of the parishioners, and there was little moral conviction. So it's not surprising that 90% of Catholics don't support the use of birth control. some of you may say that I'm soft on, or I'm taking this position because of my Catholicism, but it's probably just the opposite. I had to examine it much closer, just like I examined all the other doctrinal issues, and I came to this conclusion. But here's where my convictions on this matter start. According to the Word of God in Psalms 127, "Except the Lord build the house, the labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, sit up late, eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate." It's been said before that children are too much of a burden. Demographically speaking, it's the other way around. The elderly singles and parents, the elderly will be too much of a burden on the children. When Social Security first started, there were 8.5 workers per retiree. Now there's about 3 people per retiree. And the system is already broke. It's already in the red. According to Social Security estimates, in the next 20 years, there'll be 2 workers per retiree. Though few expect the system to last much longer than that. The next generation will return the favor of this disrespect for life by birth control and abortion through the form of euthanasia. Consider this. 1, the country's broke. 2, there's no moral or spiritual anchor within the population in general and in the medical field specifically. And 3, people cannot conceptualize any benefit or blessing of suffering in any form. The least unpleasantness in life is what people are after. So you take those 3 factors together, and that's the perfect storm for euthanasia. Fewer and fewer people today have no desire to care for their patients, for their parents. And I see this quite frequently in the emergency rooms. They drop off their parents in the ER, and it's my job to find a place for these rejected elderly people. So what happens when all the resources dry up? One of my colleagues summed it up best, and he said that people are just going to be dropping like flies. And I don't mean to alarm people, but it's coming. There's going to be some radical changes in the future. And these are things that we need to think about. We're God's people. We know better. We are the light. We must stop the cycle. God's light shines through us, and we need to show that through people in our daily lives. Did you know that experts in each say that each child costs about $200,000 to raise? Our people are good at getting bulk discounts, but it's still pretty expensive. I know I shouldn't, but sometimes I tease my children. I say to this child, "You're my sports car." And that's usually the hyperactive one. Another one, "My vacation." That's the easygoing one. And another one, "My new tractor," usually the strong one. And actually, they all like to be that one. And another one, "My shiny new implements." And that's the one that usually has 5 sets of shoes in her closet. They laugh along with me because they know their worth is much more than anything that money can buy. Those things rust and they wear out, and you can't take them to heaven, but you can take your children to heaven. So, what does birth control cost? I think it's a lot more than the $15 to $50 a month. There's a social, a moral, and a spiritual cost that some people have of. Socially, just as in the past, the churches in the past rejected because of promiscuity. It separates recreation from recreation. Before 1960, the very advertising of any contraception was illegal. it was common sense, again, for almost all people that it resulted in immorality. After 1960, the result was the sexual revolution, which speaks for itself. And in case it doesn't, here are a few statistics. 5% of births were illegitimate in 1960. Now they're up to 40. In some communities, it's 70%. Divorce. In 1900 in Canada, there were 15 divorces total. In the United States, from 1960 to 1980, the divorce rate increased about 150%. And this doesn't include the incredible rise in the cohabitation rate, where couples don't even marry. This has skyrocketed tenfold over this time period. It may be true that taking away birth control will not solve all these people, or foregoing birth control will not solve all these ills, but it's indisputable that the lie and temptation of sin without consequences has wreaked havoc on our nation and has influenced our community. Secondly, the moral cost, the taking of life. All hormonal birth control functions by 3 mechanisms. Number 1, it stops ovulation. That in itself isn't morally inherently immoral. But it can fail to do so in 25% of the ovulation cycles. second mechanism is that it makes the travel of the male seed difficult. And that also isn't morally inherently wrong, since this occurs before conception. The third mechanism is that it makes the lining of the womb inhospitable to implantation. It thins the lining of the womb, in other words. This, in effect, causes a microabortion. The morning after pill, which is simply a high-dose birth control, that's all it is, and in fact, they used usual birth control pills in a higher dose before the marketed morning after pill came out, works within 72 hours. Early pregnancy factor, that's a hormone that's produced after conception, shows up as early as 24 hours after conception, after relations. So you can see that that this can act as an early abortifacient. Randy Alcorn, he's an evangelist that you may be familiar with, makes the case much better than I can. In fact, I have some resources in the back there. They're free for the taking. The other one is by the Hess family. It's called a full quiver. And I guess it's important to know, too, that being full quiver-minded, and of course that comes from Psalms 123, doesn't mean having all the children you can possibly have. It means accepting what God has for you in your lives. And I think they make that point as well. So to take hormonal birth control is like going hunting on your property and noticing some rustling in the brushes. Do you shoot first, hoping that it's not a family member in the bush? Or, in other words, do we assume that the first two mechanisms are taking care of things and just hope that it's not the fortification mechanism? Or do you hold your fire until you find out? So the third cost of birth control is spiritual. The most expensive cost that I think is there. It goes against natural law. Marital relations and child rearing go together. If a couple is not mature enough for children when they marry, ministers should recognize that they're not mature enough for marriage, and they should say so. And it separates God's intent from behavior. Most importantly, it fosters the spirit of abortion. And I might get some flack for that, and that's okay if you challenge me on it. I think I'm ready for it. But same as the spirit of lust, the spirit of murder. And how so, do you say? Well, I think Christians are held to a higher standard. It's Matthew 5:20 and then 27. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that it was said of them by old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whosoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And 27, ye have heard that it is said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say to you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery, and in her, with her already in his heart. So the standard of God's righteousness holds that unrighteousness in our hearts is the same as unrighteousness committed. This is the spirit of abortion, where there is the desire to lead an uncomplicated life without the bother of children. In other words, birth control and abortion result in the same end, no children. It's only by the means that are different. Just as lust and adultery on one hand, and anger and the murder on the other hand, result in the same ends, an unrighteous and corrupt heart. It's only the means that are different, physical versus mental. Because I see the consequences on a daily basis, any one of these three costs, the social, the moral, or the spiritual, are enough for me to give quite a pause to recommending any kind of birth control, hormonal birth control especially, the most important being the spiritual cost. Keep in mind, though, that if you want to get your doctor's opinion, bear in mind that the only doctors that say birth control is not abortion are Christian doctors. And the reason for that is, or rather, most pro-abortion doctors readily accept this fact, that there is an abortifacient aspect to it, as it creates complicity. In other words, if the Christians take an abortifacient, they cannot criticize others who utilize surgical abortion. And most Christians are not willing to go without their birth control. I've also not known a Christian doctor who prescribes birth control only to married couples. There may be a few, but they're few and far between. The pressure is too high and the lines are too vague. Do you prescribe to someone who's divorced and remarried? What about women who are at high risk for adultery? Do you prescribe to them? So I called out one of my Christian colleagues on this issue, and this was during residency, and he asked me if he was a bad Christian for prescribing birth control. I told him a millstone is awfully difficult to swim with. That may be over the top for you, but we're talking about lives here. But whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone would be hanged around his neck, that he were drowned in the depths of the sea. It's incredibly heartbreaking to see 12 and 13-year-olds be prescribed with birth control and not a word else said to them. So I was able to convey to him that those in the position of authority, be it physician, minister, etc., have a tremendous responsibility both morally and socially to their patients. Having this knowledge, I challenged him further, and I said to continue prescribing birth control would mean one of three things. Either you don't believe life starts at conception, or you're too afraid to go against the flow, Or third, perhaps you believe that life begins at conception, but it's not really worth that much. So today, I'm happy to say that he doesn't prescribe birth control, and his quiver is full of 9 arrows. So let's take a look at the word birth control. Who is actually in control? Who gives life? Who takes life? What are the hindrances to godly thinking? Is it clear in our minds when life begins? What are our blind spots? And are there hidden biases, willful ignorance? And what is the bias the world has to offer us, and how does that affect our thinking? What is our own bias, and how do our wants affect our beliefs? So I'm right at the end of the clock, but I'll entertain a couple questions here, if there are any. Yes. Actually, not right offhand. It probably needs to be written. But not right offhand, a Christian perspective. Yes?
Just on the philosophy of the quiver, I did think a little bit of the message in 1 Corinthians, where Paul talks, writes to people about marriage. I'm sure I have people that have processed it, but it seems like another thing that the Bible sings the praises of. But Paul says that and I wish that all of you were as I am, but and it's good to stay unmarried, but and I don't want to be burdened, but if you should get married, then get married. I'm wondering how that relates to the idea of children being a blessing.
As far as being married to calm the fires or the lusts?
Well, I guess I'm thinking that in that case, there's marriage which God created, which he praised and encouraged, but at the same time seemed to say there are places where marriage is not very a specific situation.
Right.
He said, you know, people focus on their spouse rather than on the Lord. And I think children could almost be dropped into that passage in the place of marrying their spouse. Like I said, it's not fully formed, but
okay. I'm not sure I get the gist of that, but I guess from what I can gather, there's a section in Corinthians where it says it's better to marry than to burn. Is that what you're referring to? I would probably put that in the same category as Moses allowing a divorce because of the hardness of their hearts. It's not an ideal situation. And, I guess you could make a case for that, but is that what we should aspire to? You could probably make a case for that. And the other thing is, should we speak up about that if people are having struggles and difficulties? Speak up before they're married.
And I think my focus was actually on a different part, but I'm taking up way too much time.
Okay. Maybe take one more. And then, I don't want to keep you too long. Okay. Yes?
Just a comment, or maybe partially a question. I don't know if I missed it. I'm not sure if I heard you comment on the ground you were covering at the beginning regarding genetically modified animals, how you actually feel about that. I guess I would just throw out two observations. One is, it seems to me that that kind of stuff, both in animals, humans, plants, grains, etc., it feels to me like God decided how all these things should be. For us to fiddle with those knobs just opens a huge can of worms, and I think in some ways it questions the legitimacy of God making those decisions. That, to me, that's a really disturbing place to be. Secondly, I would also point out that if you, on those things, as in so many other things, if you follow the money trail, usually this is all about money eventually. I also wonder sometimes if some of the things that are talked about in prophecy in the book of Revelation specifically are some of the unforeseen fallout of our playing with genetically modified grains, etc., the famine and starvation that's talked about, if some of those things may be brought on ourselves because of playing with things we have no business with.
Okay. For you, those that didn't hear that question, comment about using genetically modified plants, animals, any of that gives the brother pause to think, are we overstepping our bounds, if I kind of recapitulate that accurately. And I can certainly respect that. It's such a temptation, and maybe the devil puts it there, to offer all these cures and benefits, crop yields and whatnot, in the name of technology. I respect that stance. We have to be able to stand the ground, though. In real life situations where you have actual hemophiliacs that need their medicine, or, you know, someone's bleeding, what do you do? The price is, if you're willing to accept that price, I can respect that. I really do. To the farmer that doesn't want to use genetically modified crops, they're going to have to take a big price, and what you're saying is that it's better to take this price now than the price later. And I can respect that. I guess at this point, I'd like to just kind of close, and I'm glad for the discussion that we had here. We brought up some good topics. These are things that we have faced, we will face, and we are facing right now, and it's good to have a solid foundation. So if you would, let's bow our heads for prayer, and we'll close. After this, we'll be dismissed. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this time together, a meeting of believers. We just thank you for your word in the scriptures, the truth that we find in there. Help us to always lean on you for our understanding. Help us to question, but to help us to question through your eyes, and help us to accept the price for our convictions, whatever stance that we take. And we just thank you for the brotherhood here, that we're able to discuss these things in your presence. We just thank you for the new generation that will be coming before us. and the challenges that they will face. And we pray for their strength. We pray for the leadership of the current generation that will also be facing these issues. And again, Lord, we just thank you for the truth that you've provided us through your living word. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you.